I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're taking a look at Donald Trump's decision to rescind national monument status to well over a million acres in the Bears Ears National Monument and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument here in Utah. Why does this matter? And more importantly, what do Native American tribes have to say about the move?
We'll also discuss the Resurrection of the Poor People's Campaign, a movement started in the 1960s by Martin Luther King Jr. This new iteration is being led by two voices in the religious left, William Barber and Liz Theo Harris, a black pastor and organizer from the South and a white theologian from the Midwest.
And for our deep dive, we'll discuss the big religious liberty case in the Supreme Court term, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. To many folks on the right, this is seen as a case of religious freedom and expression. To many on the left, it's seen as an affront to LGBT civil rights. We'll take our own look at the case, and then Amy will talk to Melissa Rogers, a church state lawyer, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and former executive director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships under President Barack Obama. Melissa will give us some more insight and context to the case and what it means for religious groups moving forward. We want to take a quick mention of something that just broke in the news at the start here. President Trump has just made an announcement that the United States is officially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and intends to move the embassy to the contested ancient city as well. This is a developing story, and this move by the Trump administration could have a significant impact on the stability of the region and the future of all religious groups who currently occupy sacred sites around the city. We'll set aside a future episode to dive into the history, context, and problems facing the divided city of Jerusalem. We'll speak to experts and what it means for the religious groups in the region and around the world. It's not something that we'll cover today, but as the story develops, we'll be sure to discuss it.
Before our deep dive into our main story of the week, we always start with each of us taking a quick hit on a story we've been following. Nish, what are you following this week?
Well, it's been a crazy week here in Utah. There are two national monuments that were rescinded, essentially, huge chunks of acreage were rescinded under President Trump. Before he left office, President Obama designated a large section of land in southern Utah, where I live here, called Bears Ears, as a national monument. It's a power that's given to the president under something called the Antiquities Act. This particular designation was led primarily by Native tribes lobbying the president for years. It started a while ago in a move that was unprecedented. Leaders from five different Native tribes came together to form what's called the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. And it consists of the Hopi tribe, the Navajo Nation, the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, the Pueblo of Zuni, and the Ute Indian tribe. It was unprecedented because historically, these tribes did not get along. They have long-standing conflicts, but they came together to lobby the government to protect this section of land. And it contains more than 100,000 Native American archaeological and cultural sites, many of which are considered sacred by many of these tribes that I just listed. And I've been to some of the sites, and they are remarkable, like truly amazing. Ancient rock paintings and petroglyphs, cliff dwellings, shrines, ancient roads that like lead along the San Juan River. It's incredible.
And just gorgeous nature out there, too.
It is unbelievable. The giant red rocks and the cliffs. I mean, it's just unbelievable country. But the Native American tribes don't just want to protect the land only for historic purposes. They actually use the land currently for spiritual ceremonies. They collect herbs for medicines. They gather food and hunt game. They gather firewood for heating their homes and performing ceremonies. And as the coalition states on their website, proper management and protection of the land, which is what this designation does, is really important because they rely on the land as both their medicine cabinet and their pantry for food, shelter, healing, and spiritual practice. They desired for the federal government to come in and protect the land and keeping it from being bought and sold for commercial purposes, specifically for gas and oil. President Obama listened, and he designated 1.5 million acres as national monument land. It was a huge win for the Native people being the first national monument ever designated at the request of sovereign native tribes. But it was also a win for conservationists and the outdoor recreation industry, which relies heavily on federal land protection to keep recreation in these areas open. But this week, President Trump reversed course and shrunk Bears Ears from 1.35 million acres to 228,000 acres. And he called the designation federal overreach. And combined with his cutting of Grand Staircase Escalante, another monument designated by President Clinton, it's the largest elimination of protected public land in U.S. history. The scaling back sets up a series of coming lawsuits against the administration, one most notably from Yvonne Chouinard, the founder of the outdoor brand Patagonia, who's gearing up to sue. Lots of folks were outside the state capitol on Monday, including yours truly, to protest the move by Trump and to stand with Native tribes. It was so cold. It was like 30 degrees outside. My fingers were frozen. To stand with Native tribes for their right to protect the land that's theirs to begin with. So that's my story.
So I can't listen to this story without thinking of the context of what happened last week. I think it was just last week. Time moves so differently in the Trump era, but which was Trump welcoming Native American veterans, the Code Talkers, to the Oval Office, and then proceeding to insult them in so many ways that didn't even get mentioned, because the big focus was the fact that he decided to go after Elizabeth Warren again, referring to her just, you know, breezily as Pocahontas. They call her Pocahontas. No, nobody calls her Pocahontas. He calls her Pocahontas. And by the way, that's offensive to use that as just like a generic term for a Native American woman. But he wouldn't understand that. In fact, I believe his son, Eric Trump, tweeted about how it was ironic that people were so upset about this because Disney put out a movie called Pocahontas. And I swear to you, Nish, I don't think they know that Pocahontas was a real person.
I really don't think they do.
This has happened before, actually, and it doesn't make it okay.
Of course it doesn't make it okay, because you're the freaking president of the United States. You should know this.
No, but it is an example of how, like, I've never met anybody who lives in such a little rarefied bubble that they can just make reality and facts to suit themselves. So one of my favorite anecdotes about Trump from the Apprentice era is the time that he insisted on calling Lil Jon Uncle Tom, and all of his producers and like everybody on the show was horrified. They kept trying to explain to him that that's like not a thing that you call people. It's not like, hey, buddy, hey, Uncle Tom. And he, like, in the face of everybody saying, this is actually extremely offensive, you cannot do this, was like, yeah, no, guys, I think you're wrong. I think he's fine with it.
What?
So this is just another example of it. But anyway, like, that would be bad enough to do this and then right after it decide this would be a really good time to take back all this land as well. Just kind of, it would blow my mind if my mind was still intact, but it is not.
It's been blown too many times.
I know that you've been following this aspect of it, but I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about kind of the sacred significance of this land and how that is figuring into this as a concern among some of the tribes.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually going to be really interested to see how some of these lawsuits take shape, because I think there's, I mean, you're going to see lawsuits about this, the rescinding of the designation and the scaling back of the lands. You're going to see lawsuits coming from a lot of different angles. You'll see some from the tribes, you'll see some from the outdoor industry, you'll see some from like across the board. And so it's going to be really interesting to me to see how each group kind of tackles the issue. Let me say this. I would not be surprised if a religious freedom case in some way comes up in regards to this particular designation, because there are areas of these lands that were designated both ancient and current that are used specifically for spiritual Native American ceremonies. And so if that land is not federally protected and the land has the ability by the state of Utah to be sold off to oil and gas, like what does that do for the rights of Native Americans to use the land for spiritual and religious purposes? So it's going to be really interesting to see how it all kind of takes shape. Regarding the land itself, I don't know exactly what like specific areas or what specific sites are used, but I do know that there are several that are deemed quote unquote sacred. And that word sacred probably has a pretty broad connotation because there are some that are sacred that connect them with their ancestors, but the connection to ancestors for a lot of Native American tribes is connected through the land itself. And so
the land itself, right?
Right. And so there's going to be a lot that you'll hear about that in some of these cases. But yeah, it's super interesting. Now, I'm really hoping to get someone from one of the five tribes, one of the Intertribal Coalition, to come on the show and kind of like walk us through some of these things and why some of these ceremonies and why the land is so important to their spiritual life in the life of these particular tribes that have lobbied for years for this designation. But I couldn't get anyone in time for us to record. So hopefully as we see some of these cases move through the courts, we'll be able to get someone to kind of come in and explain a little bit more intricately than I ever could, you know, why these lands are so sacred. But I do know that they, you know, use them for herbs and medicines and for healing practices as well. That was one of the things that was brought up by all of the tribes. And so it's just a very, very fraught time right now. And there's a lot of arguments from folks who were against the designation saying like, well, if it was so important, they should have designated it a long time ago. But people don't realize like it took a long time for the tribes to come together and to lobby the government. This took place over several years, talking about like exactly how much acreage, what are the boundaries, what needs to be included, what artifacts are included. Like there were all these different aspects to the negotiations with the government on what was going to be protected and what wasn't. So this actually was a pretty involved process. It wasn't rushed like a lot of people are making it out to be. And so because it was this process and it was unprecedented in the way these tribes came together, it feels like such a slap in the face. It feels like a slap in the face for these tribes. It feels like a slap in the face for the people of Utah who love to visit this land and want to see it preserved for their kids. I would love to be able to take my kids down to Bears Ears and to Grand Escalante in the future and not see it, you know, as land that was sold to oil and gas companies and for mining, which could actually destroy the landscape. So I don't know. We're going to see how it develops, but that's just some more info for you. I wish I could say more about the sacredness of it, but I would rather have bring someone in who's a practicing expert on that than to have me kind of rattle off about something I don't know.
Yes, please. We'll look forward to that.
So Amy, what about you? You've got a pretty cool story.
I do. But you know what? You've just reminded me about another story, so I'm going to cheat and wedge that in here as well. Because just the potential for religious exercise suit here, I think, raises a really interesting area that may be explored more during the Trump era, which is testing out whether the loudest advocates of religious freedom and religious liberty have a broad conception of what they mean by that, or if it's religious liberty for me, but not for thee, which is something we have heard quite a lot.
I have some things to say about that when we get to our main story, but I'm going to hold my tongue for now.
So I just wanted to toss out there, this actually I think was announced in early October, but I didn't see anything about it until yesterday, which is that there are a couple of lawsuits going forward right now challenging the rolling back of the contraceptive coverage mandate. And a plaintiff in one of them is an evangelical Christian, a graduate of Fuller Seminary, and an employee of a faith-based organization. And she's really interesting, very articulate. Her name's Alicia Baker, and she is suing the administration.
She's actually suing the Trump administration, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this, but I would like us to keep our eyes on suits like this, because it is usually assumed, I think, not by the actual practitioners in these cases, but in the folks who consider themselves advocates of religious freedom, that all of the people with those kinds of claims fall on the right. You know, when they get pushback from people elsewhere, or, you know, never mind the ideological spectrum, when they get pushback from people outside of their small religious community, like, say, Muslims, who feel like their religious freedom is being trampled on in several areas, then you get to see a lot of backpedaling. I'm like, well, maybe that's not what we're thinking of when we say religious freedom. So anyway, I just am keeping my eyes on that and wanted to flag it for our listeners who, like me, may not have noticed that before now. But the main story, because as you know, I love any time I see coverage of the religious left, because there's so little of it.
Because evangelicals and the religious right have dominated the news cycle for like decades.
Well, there's that, but actually, this is a key part of the story that I wanted to raise, which is there is, as we know, a double standard when it comes to reporting on religion. And that is that anything that some like fringy extreme group on the right does is worthy of like blanket coverage. So this used to happen all the time when Fred Phelps and what's the name of his?
Westboro Baptist.
You know, they got headlines and continue sometimes to get headlines so far beyond what is merited by the reach of their tiny little group, and often without the context of you know, who they were and whether anybody listened to them other than the journalist. This happened now, I guess it would be 6 or 7 years ago, with the dude down in Florida who was burning Qurans. And really, again, was just a dude. It's not like he led a mega church. He didn't even lead a church, but he was getting front page coverage because he would like send out faxes about what he was doing.
Faxes. Remember those?
Yeah. It has long bothered me that like these guys can get tons of coverage, but when people on the religious left try to do something, it's just yawn. Oh, are they right. talking about peace and justice again? Because blah, blah.
Right. It's like the down normalization of fringe groups in religion reporting, really, is what it is.
Yeah, but it is also, it's deciding whose issues are important issues. Because it actually is pretty radical to be talking about the poor. And to be insisting that that should be in the center of our politics, which is what they are doing by trying to revive King's poverty campaign. I mean, that does not get as close to as much attention as King's work in the civil rights movement did, because he was killed as he was starting it up, killed just 4 months into the year in 1968. And, you know, as with so many things that were part of his legacy, this kind of didn't last long beyond his life either. But so we've got the simple fact of religious left leaders trying to start up again a focus on the poor. I mean, I think you could argue that aside from tying it to what King did, this isn't incredibly revolutionary, because people like Jim Wallis, just to name one, have been talking about the poor for decades through Sojourners. Reverend Barber himself has. He's been doing Moral Mondays for a very long time. And, you know, I hope somebody out there is doing a dissertation on why Moral Mondays took off when it did, because this wasn't like the first time William Barber decided to go out and talk about injustice and talk about poverty. But it really did like reach this moment where all of a sudden it was getting coverage and thousands of people were gathering to rally with him. And, you know, maybe it was because the state government in North Carolina got to a point where people were just fed up. But whatever it is, he has become a real galvanizing figure. And he has a number of colleagues of other races as well. who have been joining with him to protest the repeal of Obamacare, to protest the tax bill. They've been getting arrested just this week at the Senate, getting arrested over the treatment of Dreamers. You know, the religious left is really active, and in some ways that has been part of the problem, that there are so many things to be concerned about, and in many ways it's hard to make people prioritize, because how do you pick what's more important when people are suffering? How do you say that the death penalty is more important than whether hungry children are able to get food? How do you say that whether immigrant families are broken up is more important than, you know, people having their health care taken away? Like, it is just, it's a problem of prioritization. And so one issue has often always been kind of the media savviness of folks on the left, who hate it when I even bring that up, because they say we shouldn't have to be savvy. But it just, it is the reality of trying to catch anybody's attention. It's not journalists. It's all of us are busy. And it's a matter of trying to just stop us for a few minutes, a few seconds. So all of that to say,
it's like the age of Trump, right? Like it's the nature of the beast that a tweet by the president of the United States is going to get more wall-to-wall news coverage than religious leaders being arrested outside the Senate Majority Leader's office. Like, that is the reality of the news cycle that we live in. And so if we want these issues to be more front and center, if this actually is important, that we want it to get it out in front of more people, that savviness does actually play a part. It just, I mean, it's unfortunate, because these sorts of things, like what you were saying, it shouldn't have to be, like, we shouldn't have to be savvy. This should be just basic humanity caring about these things. But it's just kind of the nature of the beast, unfortunately, of where we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't even think it's like a failing of society to not be able to focus and to care. I mean, I'll admit, whenever I get press releases that's like, oh, 60 religious leaders put out a statement. Oh my God, I can't. It's people, please stop putting out statements, especially when it's all the same names. I always scan very quickly. If nothing jumps out at me as like, oh, you wouldn't expect to see that person on here, then it actually is not news. And it saddens people to hear that, but it is just the case. I'll tell you, though, what does get my attention, and this is, I wanted to turn it around with, like, maybe these are some other things that might make more of a difference going forward in terms of raising up the concerns and the voices of progressive people of faith. One is the kind of, and this was from years ago, but it's just an example of how to actually grab people's attention, which was, I want to say it was like 5 or 6 years ago, Paul Ryan had showed up to one of the Ralph Reed confabs. Maybe it's the Faith and Freedom. I can't remember what, like, word salad that they put together, but I think it's, pretty sure it was the Faith and Freedom conference. And a young Catholic activist just walked up to him with a Bible and tried to hand it to Paul Ryan. And he had a friend with a video recorder behind him. And he said, you know, here, sir, I hope that you spend more time reading this instead of Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand.
So yes. Awesome. Mostly because...
hero status.
Because Ryan just, like, immediately jumped back like the Bible was going to bite him or something. And so they followed him, like, half jogging to his black SUV and, like, tearing out of there. And the image was just like this Republican leader who can't take a moment. He's just so so unwilling to interact with somebody who wants to press him on this stuff, to press him on reconciling his faith and the political views that he's spouting. So that was, I thought, a really good, savvy example of trying to get some attention, and it worked. But the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately that I wonder if it will turn out to be kind of a turning point right now, is things like, and don't laugh, but Jimmy Kimmel fighting on Twitter with Roy Moore, who says things like, you know, Jimmy, you need to come down here and see what Christians really like. And Jimmy Kimmel saying like, excuse me, sir, I am a Christian.
Let me know when you get those Christian values. I'll be there. I about fell out of my chair. I thought it was
amazing. It's not just the calling out Roy Moore as a hypocrite, because liberals have been doing that for decades. This is, and I've been keeping an ear and an eye out for this for a long, long time. So it does jump out at me. It is unusual to have somebody like Jimmy Kimmel stand up and affirmatively say, I am a Christian.
Yeah.
And I have values. Like, you don't get to decide who is a Christian. Another example of this was maybe last week or the week before, one of my former Time colleagues, David Vondrelli, who is one of the most wonderful, smart, like even-headed people you can think of. And he wrote just an on fire column in the Washington Post, where he's a columnist now, called Christians, Our Silence on Roy Moore Isn't Enough. And writers don't write their own headlines. So I thought that that might not have been what David intended. But the entire piece is just written as a Christian, calling out other Christians to stop just staying on the sidelines and being quiet. That, of course, other people are going to come to stand for the Christian name if you don't get out there and assert that it's your faith too and that you don't agree with them. And so, again, you know, these are just a couple of examples. I don't know if it's going to turn the tide, but it's the only thing that will, because nobody's going to cover a bunch of do-gooder tree huggers, even though I wish that they did. They're going to keep covering the weirdos on the left or on the right. And it's going to take like people in the middle who you wouldn't think of as like a Christian activist saying, hang on, no, that's my faith too. And you are not a proper representative of it. So anyway, that gets me all excited. But
I want to ask you a couple questions about, or maybe just one question about the Poor People's Campaign specifically.
Yeah.
What are the, do we have any sort of like indications of what are the maybe hardcore specifics in policy that they're advocating for? I would guess healthcare. I would guess, you know, fair tax.
Minimum wage.
Yeah, working minimum wage. I would guess taxes that don't benefit the rich but also benefit the middle class and poor. I would guess immigration would probably be in there because the status and livelihood of immigrants in this country is declining.
Yeah, trying to restore funding to the social safety net.
Yep. Okay. So Medicare, Medicaid.
Medicare, Medicaid. Yeah. Some of what used to be thought of as welfare doesn't really exist anymore. But, you know, even the pieces, small pieces that have been left are being taken away with people. We will not go down the Eric Erickson rabbit hole here. But, you know.
Don't make me do it.
People pushing the idea that, you know, this is really more appropriately dealt with by individuals and, you know, private institutions. It's the old faith-based argument that, you know, houses of worship should be taking care of this stuff. And the thing is, they are,
but there's still not enough money.
if every church in America, like, devoted $50,000 to trying to feed the hungry, it still wouldn't quite address the problem. And that's just one issue. So the idea that there are resources, you know, among churches, many of which are really struggling right now, is just, it's a willful denial of reality, the reality of problems and the reality of how you solve them. But yeah, that's a big part of it. And just, you know, challenging candidates, and to be frank, we're talking about Democratic candidates. They're not going to be getting Republican candidates in 2020 to be talking about poverty. And so, you know, it's kind of a rehash of what happened in the 2000s with John Edwards talking about poverty. You had other activists from the religious left who met with him and with Kerry and later on Hillary and Obama, trying to get them to focus on the poor. And other than Edwards, who, say what you want about John Edwards, and there is a lot to say, I give him credit that he is really the only major candidate who's run in a party nominating contest who has talked about the poor and who has given a crap about it.
Yeah. Is the Poor People's Campaign strictly a Christian movement, or are we seeing inclusion of different faith communities? Because I know that, like, I mean, whether it's Judaism, Islam, I mean, there is a thread that runs through a lot of the religious landscape worldwide, but definitely in America, of taking care of the poor. Like, this is not specifically a Christian thing, but taking care of the poor and the less fortunate is a value that is held by a lot of different religions. So are we seeing different religious leaders from different traditions being involved in the Poor People's Campaign, or is it right now pretty Christian focused? Do you know?
Well, most of these efforts have been pretty ecumenical. You've got some Reform Jewish groups signed on. I assume that there will be other groups as well. That's always been the case in the past. But in terms of the leadership, I think they are focusing on the fact that you've got a black man and a white woman, both sharing the same religious tradition and getting out there and trying to say, you know, this shouldn't matter whether you're black, whether you're white. Like, this is an issue that is at the foundation of where we go as a country and what our values are.
Yeah.
So we'll be following that and letting listeners know what happens with it. But
yeah, it's great
to keep us on time here. We should move on to our main story this week, and note that we're recording this episode on Wednesday, December 6th. Yesterday morning, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, otherwise known as the polarizing, quote, gay wedding cake case. The basics of this case are this. A baker refused to take an order for one of his wedding cakes from a gay couple who was planning to get married in the state of Colorado, stating that he had a First Amendment right to deny the couple that service. It is the highest profile case around LGBT rights that the Supreme Court has heard since its landmark ruling legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide in 2015. And one of the things that I talked to Melissa Rogers about, and you'll hear that interview after our discussion, was why, in fact, the Supreme Court chose this case. Because I think there have been enough instances of denial of services that people knew they were going to try to address it at some point. But this particular case just has some problems that came up during the arguments yesterday. She described, you know, a couple of the more liberal justices almost tag-teaming the lawyers and saying, well, you are arguing that it's a matter of artistic expression for a wedding cake maker, that this isn't just a client and a service, but, you know, their right to expression. So what about if it was a jeweler or a florist or the makeup artist or the DJ or this or that? And it does kind of raise the tricky question of, like, you know, are you trying, yes, to single out and hold up one profession over another in terms of having special rights of expression? So that's one of the many issues that come up. The other, just quite frankly, I have had a really hard time kind of thinking through this case. I know where I stand on denial of services and think that that is wrong.
Well, that's been settled.
I know where I stand.
For the most part.
Yes. I know where I stand on the politicization of religious freedom as a wedge issue. And I am on record as being greatly annoyed about that. What I'm not sure about is whether the opposite of denial of services is you must take on every client who comes along. And I'm just not sure what the answer to that is.
I heard an option recently that was like, well, what if the baker made the cake, you know, put like, you know, the general frosting on the outside. But when it came to actually decorating it or putting something on top of it, like they had to go do that somewhere else. Or like I don't know, like there's all sorts of weird options. And it feels like this case feels a little slippery to me in some ways, because I feel like it shifted. I don't know if Melissa felt this way, but it feels like it shifted. It shifted from something that seemed like, oh, religious freedom, to, quote, freedom of speech. And it's like, okay, well, what is it? What is it? Which one is it? Is religious freedom like tied in with religious or with the freedom of speech? Like where is the line? Is there a line? Like there's all sorts of weird and tricky things about this case that, frankly, I am not a law expert. I am not a lawyer, like not in the slightest. So my legal expertise here is very limited.
Well, and that these Supreme Court justices who are experts, you know, they may not clear it up in their decision. There's also a slight chance that they just decide to kick it back to the state, because there's kind of a small possibility for them to do that. I would not be shocked if they did.
Yeah, and if they did kick it back to the state, it's in favor of the couple, because LGBT people are what's called, isn't it called like a protected class? Or I can't remember. There's not a federal designation for LGBT people for that.
But it would not be the end of this conversation.
No, it wouldn't. The thing that I found was so interesting about this, and my husband and I talked about this recently, that approaching it from a religious freedom standpoint, comparing it with other religious freedom cases that the court has heard recently, I think about the Muslim prisoner in, I think it's a supermax prison, who wanted to grow his beard out to a quarter inch. And that was a religious freedom case. There are a couple others. The difference here in this case that I've noticed, as opposed to some of these other religious freedom cases, is that in the other religious freedom cases that have come in front of the court, there hasn't been, for lack of a better term, human victims, right? That there's not a, like, civil repercussion in these other cases like there has in this one. Like there is a harm, or there is a, you know, potential harm that is afflicted on a particular group of people for who they are. Whereas these other religious cases, it had to do with like a man growing his beard. So there wasn't like a man growing his beard is not going to.
Right. It's an individual's right. It's not a clash.
That's exactly right. And so it seemed at first, when this was being couched as a religious freedom case, as what, I mean, frankly, what's more important, religious freedom or civil rights? It seemed like that was how the case was being framed from the get-go. But then when it was argued in front of the court, that wasn't the tack that they took, which I thought was really interesting. The other thing that I have found to be really interesting about this particular case, and I'm interested to hear if Melissa got into this, was, I mean, probably not, because this is just much more the religious, like evangelical bent for me. The one thing that I have noticed in the evangelical world is the shift that has happened toward quote unquote religious freedom when it comes to LGBT rights. We used to couch, or the evangelical tradition used to couch LGBT issues as quote unquote family values. Right. That was what we always heard, that it was like family values, family values, family values. But ever since, as in protecting the traditional family, not allowing gay marriage, what we hear when it comes to LGBT issues amongst evangelicalism is religious freedom. And I don't know, like, I don't know if that's true, but that's, I mean, that's just an observation that I have made to a few people, to say like, we don't hear about family values anymore, but we sure hear a lot about religious freedom. You know, are they as out religious freedom, which brings us back to the conversation that we had that I said I was going to hold off on, is religious freedom for me?
No. Well, this goes back to one of our favorite topics, which is the persecution complex. I mean, that's what it's about. What I see this as part of is also the adoption of what are really just secular symbols as having religious meaning, by which I mean, yeah, like being married before God does not require cake. Like It could just be a party.
So good, right? Anyway.
Could just be a party. Well, yeah, actually, I was going to say. So we had two sheet cakes because they cost like $100 each. And having a decorated cake was going to be $1,000. And I was like, that's ridiculous. It tastes just as good as a sheet cake. People are just going to get a piece like on their plate anyway. Who cares what it looks like? I want to put more money into taking a honeymoon. Anyway, but we could have had cookies or pies or whatever, and we would have still been married. Same thing with florists. And like, none of these things are required. None of these things constitute, you know, holy Christian marriage. And yet they are being held up as like, how could you possibly ask me, a Christian, to endorse this wedding by making a cake? You can imagine it extending to, you know, selling you this wedding band. Or, you know, the right likes to talk about slippery slopes a lot, but, you know, you can imagine just as many slippery slopes along these lines. Although that would be kind of awesome. Well, there will be time for us to come back to it. If the court doesn't punt it, then it will be decided next summer, probably is one of the later cases, because it's going to be a controversial one. And I made Melissa promise that she would come back and talk to us about it once that happens, so she can explain it to us. We have a lot of opinions about the Masterpiece Cake case, obviously. But I wanted to talk with Melissa Rogers to get some actual legal analysis from an expert. Melissa and I worked together years ago at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. She's a highly respected church state lawyer who also led the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives during Obama's second term. Melissa was inside the Supreme Court on Tuesday to hear oral arguments for the Masterpiece case, and she walked me through some of the conflicting claims, as well as what struck her about the line of questioning the justices took. So you were at the oral arguments this morning.
I was.
How did that come about?
Oh, well, I try to go to as many arguments as I can that have to do with the First Amendment religion clauses. And of course, this one touched on that, as well as free speech, the free speech clause. So I try to get there whenever I can. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to be there today, which was, you know, confirmed to be the busiest day yet at the court this term.
Wow. What was the scene like there?
It was wild. There were, you know, people in the public line started camping out as early as Friday. Thankfully, if you're a member of the Supreme Court bar, you don't have to wait in that same line. But even for the Supreme Court bar, I got there around 6:30 this morning, and I was like the 65th person in line. At 6:30 this morning for a 10 o'clock argument.
Oh, wow.
And after the argument, there were competing rallies next to one another, you know, for the respective parties in the case with their own chants, and they were very loud and boisterous and intent on, you know, getting their message across in the wake of the argument. So you don't always see so much excitement outside the court for all cases. Mm-hmm. This one has awakened a lot of passions.
In the actual argument itself, in terms of the questioning and what followed, was there anything that surprised you?
Well, one thing that I found interesting was that Justice Kennedy, who, you know, was often the swing vote, had very pointed questions for both sides. He came out very strong out of the box with questions for the attorneys for the bakery. And he, you know, wanted to know things like, you know, is this going to result in a boycott, shops boycotting gay marriages, and signs going up in the window of various establishments saying that, you know, certain products wouldn't be available for gay marriages, and if so, wouldn't that be an affront to the gay community? And, you know, knowing his record, he's been a leader on LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, that was not unexpected, but he was, you know, the pointed nature of his questions were, you know, were notable. And then when the other side, the side defending the state of Colorado, got up, he was at least as pointed in his questions for them. Now, you know, in a way that, again, is not that surprising. He's both an advocate of LGBT rights, an advocate of free speech rights, and also, you know, religious freedom. He's been vocal about that. But it seemed, you know, as if he's very conflicted about this case. So, you know, it was interesting to see him really go after both sides. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when the state got up, you know, he was saying things like, well, I just don't think that in this case that there has been, you know, the kind of respect that should be shown to this baker. And he also, you know, at one point said something, and I'm trying to find it in the transcript now, but he said, tolerance is essential in a free society, and tolerance is most meaningful when it's mutual. It seems to me that the state in its position here has been neither tolerant nor respectful of Mr. Phillips' religious beliefs. That's the baker's name, Phillips. So, you know, you can't, it's risky, very risky to decide to try to predict, you know, what will happen based on an oral argument, but it seems pretty safe to say that he's going to be a key vote in this case. And, you know, he definitely had concerns on both sides.
Mm-hmm. It has, honestly been a tough case for me to think about. And I wonder whether it's surprising that, the court chose this particular case in which to think through the question of denial of services.
Yeah, yeah. One always wonders, you know, who were the four justices who recommended that the court take the case, because it only takes four justices mm-hmm. for a case to be granted. For the cert grant to be made, and who were those four justices, and what was their thinking? Mm-hmm. And this is one of those cases because, you know, you really saw, I guess what you'd call a hot bench. The justices were very engaged, wicked hypos coming left and right throughout the oral argument. You know, some of them really struggling with, you know, how they would resolve these issues. So they gave themselves a tough assignment, I think, mm-hmm. with this case.
Mm-hmm. And how should we be thinking about the religious liberty issues that are at play here? Often, obviously, in many cases, you've got two individual sets of rights and concerns kind of coming up against each other. But in this case, you really seem to have two different individual liberties at odds.
Well, certainly, yes, you have the equality interest, the non-discrimination interest. And, you know, that is very prominent in this case. And indeed, you know, the justices, many of them were really struggling with any way to limit, you know, if they were to grant the bakeries, you know, an exemption from this Colorado non-discrimination law, then what kind of line would they draw that would not end up doing great damage to that non-discrimination principle? And one of the, you know, the really interesting parts of the argument were a sort of tag team performance by Justices Kagan and Ginsburg when they started going through, okay, what side of the line are these various people on? And then they started listing out the baker, the florist, the photographer, the singer, the invitation designer, the, right, jeweler, the jeweler, the hairstylist, the makeup artist, the chef, the tailor. So
the candlestick maker.
They really had, yeah, exactly, exactly. And they, you know, they basically were saying, is this about conduct or is this about speech? And if it's about speech, then where are we going to draw this line? And Justice Breyer, you know, often joining in and saying, really, you know, these are very bedrock ideas about equality in the commercial, you know, marketplace, and how are we going to make sure that that we don't make mincemeat of mm-hmm. that kind of protection? Because a protection for this baker to turn away people based on their sexual orientation, you know, the next case could be turning away people because they're in an interreligious marriage, mm-hmm. or, you know, turning away people because of something else about their religion that, you know, that a baker would not like, whether that's an atheist baker or a religious baker. Mm-hmm. And so that interest, you know, certainly came to the fore. And then it's pitted against a claim for free speech or for free exercise. Frankly, the free speech claim, I think almost everybody would agree that because of the doctrine that exists in the Supreme Court's precedent, that the free speech claim is stronger than the free exercise claim. Mm-hmm. And that's in large part because the Supreme Court back in 1990, because of an opinion written by Justice Scalia for a very divided court, really diminished the kinds of protection that are given to free exercise of religion through the First Amendment. So the case focused more on free speech, and it certainly focused on the fact that, you know, the baker has these religious beliefs, and he doesn't want to express certain things that are in conflict with his religion, but then again on the other side saying, well, wait a minute, is this really speech, what the state's trying to do here is just to say we're trying to regulate conduct, and we're mm-hmm. trying to make sure that everybody gets that, you know, is covered by this particular law is treated the same in a commercial business, you know, a for-profit business that's open to the public, and Masterpiece advertises its services, you know, come in, order cake from us. And the concern about the, you know, the dignitary harm and the harm to a quality interest that would be done if an exemption is recognized in a case like this, and then perhaps many others. Mm-hmm.
And do we have a sense that this is really only relevant when you're talking about taking on clients in this case for a wedding cake, that, you know, if it was a gay couple coming in and wanting to commission a cake for one of them for their birthday, for, you right. know, just a secular party, that this would just be on its face. There would be no claim.
No, I don't think that's clear. And I think Justice Kagan had a very important line of questioning when she said, is this just about weddings, or what couldn't the same kind of reasoning apply to funerals, to bar mitzvahs, mm-hmm. to communions, mm-hmm. anniversary celebrations, birthdays? You know, she used one particular example of a same-sex couple goes to a restaurant with a great chef for their anniversary celebration. Mm-hmm. And the chef says, I don't do anniversary celebrations for same-sex couples. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think you can quickly see how it's, you know, it's very difficult to limit a principle here in a way that, you know, would be minimal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, this is an extremely tricky area. But do we know kind of what to expect next, or it's really just going to be Justice Kennedy kind of thinking yeah. through this and being the deciding voice?
Well, you never know. And as I said, you know, oral argument can be misleading because they are thinking out loud. They always say things that you know that when they go back to their desks and think about it more, that they may think better of some of the lines of argument that they were pursuing. And I think I've seen that happen with Kennedy and other justices. So it's hard to predict, but pardon me. But what happens now, or usually, is that the case is submitted, and then we get a decision. And in these kinds of cases, it almost always comes down late in the term mm-hmm. because it's a challenging case to decide, and then a challenging opinion or opinions to write. Mm-hmm. I would suspect in this case, it's definitely opinions, plural. So yes, we're waiting. We'll probably, if it follows the usual pattern, we won't hear more from the justices until they hand down their decision. But, you know, there was some suggestion, because in the oral argument, there was some discussion about whether the Colorado Commission had been inappropriately biased against religion, shown hostility toward religion. And if the court decides, goes into the record and decides that there's been bias shown in particular, then, you know, it's not out of the realm of comprehension that they might say, you know, this needs to go back down to, you know, the Colorado state executive branch agencies and then the courts to kind of do a redo or, you know, have aspects of this reconsidered. So in that way, they would punt it for a while. Mm-hmm. Probably not likely, but not impossible that that would happen. So, you know, it's not, you can't be confident that we will in several months' time have a decision that is a definitive ruling on the merits.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and we know whichever way it comes down, we'll have people concerned about the slippery slope.
Right.
Aspects.
And that's, you know, you couldn't have had a better illustration of that than walking down the court steps today and seeing about, you know, equal throngs of people, you know, chanting. And, you know, what the likelihood is that one of those group of people is going to be very disappointed by the court's ruling. And then where will we go from there? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the state of play on these issues in our country at this time in our history.
Well, if and when we do get a ruling, we may have to check back with you to figure out what it all means. But thank you for thinking through this.
I'd be happy to do it.
Excellent. Thanks, Melissa.
To wrap up the show, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation or two, maybe a TV show, a movie, a new album, or a podcast. Amy, what are you loving this week?
Well, Nish, I am glad that you asked.
Oh, Lord.
I think you're going to be excited about this because you don't even know.
Okay, tell me.
So we do not yet have any in-plate company swag. I really wish we did, but...
I'd be down for that.
Have to get to the point where we are not losing money before we do that.
Putting money out of our pockets into a podcast.
But because I love you all so much, I have put together on Spotify an Impolite Company holiday playlist. Yes.
Wait, I did not get a say in this.
Well, I may give you the password so that you can add some songs to this, but I take great pride in my holiday playlist because there is some really bad holiday music out there.
Bad.
And a few years ago, I decided, actually, it was after I follow Michelle Norris on Twitter. And every year when she's like doing holiday baking and cooking, she will live tweet the songs that she's listening to. And she had some awesome songs. So I put some of those on my playlist and then I just started looking and it grew from there. So go to Spotify and it is called An Impolite Company Holiday. And you're welcome because it will just make, it will make your December happier. I start listening to it in August because that's the kind of year this year has been.
I started listening to Christmas music
a long time ago,
not because of the kind of year it's been, but because I'm like Buddy the Elf. Like, I love Christmas more than anything in the world. I could start baking Christmas cookies in July. That's the type of person I am. I am the obnoxious, like, let's put up the Christmas tree right after Halloween. And Eric's like, we're going to need to pull the reins back on you. So, good to know.
Well, maybe for next week, we will grace the listeners with like some Amy Grant karaoke from her Christmas albums, bringing Caitlin Beatty to debate which was the best Amy Grant holiday album. But
that's a tough call.
For the moment,
Okay.
The playlist.
I love it.
So Nish, what about you?
Okay, so I'm going to report back. I promised that I would. Last week I said that I was starting a new series on Netflix called Godless.
Yes, I've been wondering. I almost texted you to say, I need a new show. Should I watch it?
Okay. We have, well, Eric's out of town. I'm not sure if he has watched any more episodes, but I...
Have you been watching by yourself?
No, I haven't. I've been good.
Okay.
So I may cheat on him tonight, though. We'll see.
I would never do that. I would just watch the whole thing and be like, oh, act surprised the second time we watched it through.
Yes. Someone must have logged into our account. What
totally
happened?
Did that with Friday Night Lights. Like,
oh, that's
no
a good one,
they
though.
They won states.
What would Riggins do?
Yeah,
your eyes full, hearts can't
Noam
lose.
Can like watch a cliffhanger episode and then wait for like a month and a half to watch
oh,
the next
no.
one. Who does that?
The only show I can manage to do that with is... Game of Thrones, because I refuse to wait until the season's over so I can binge it. I have to watch it in real time. Like, there's just no way. But Godless, which is on Netflix, for those of you who missed last week, it's a Western. It's starring Jeff Daniels and Michelle Dockery. We now have two or three episodes left in the season, and it is so good. It is so good. I will say it's very violent. It is like Wild West gunslingers, robbers, outlaws that shoot each other. Like, it's brutal in the violence realm. It's brutal. But it is just fantastic. The cinematography is amazing. The storyline is really unique. And it is just, oh man, it is so good. And I can't wait to see how it ends. For those who didn't hear last week, it's, like I said, it's a Western, and the premise of it is there is this guy, I won't give too much of it away, but there's a guy who ends up getting kind of harbored in this town, and his former posse, his like former like outlaw posse that he was with, that he broke away from, is searching for him to kill him because they feel like he betrayed them. And so he's kind of being harbored in this town, but this town lost all of the men in a mining accident. And so it's only women, essentially, that protect this town. And so what is going to happen when the dude who is leading all the outlaws finds out that the guy who betrayed them is being held in this town where only the women are? There's going to be a big confrontation, and I am here for it, and I can't wait.
I need this show right now.
Oh, there
I
are
want
some
to move to that town.
There are some badass women, and it like there's actually a lot of really
it's
great
Lady Mary
comic.
As a cowgirl.
It's
what
pretty
is
epic.
Not to love about that.
It's pretty epic. Who has a Native American mother-in-law and a Native son that she had with her husband? Like, it's just this really intricate storyline, really great character development. It's really intense. But so, so good. So well acted. There's really good comic relief. So anyway, that is what I'm watching. Can't wait to watch the finale. Sorry, Eric, if I watch it before you get home. Because I don't know if I can wait. We'll see. The other thing, I have one more thing. I'm going to cheat since you cheated at the top. Is if you have HBO, you need to watch Nice Lady by, it's Michelle... Shoot, now I can't remember her last name. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to look it up. I know, I'm so sorry. HBO, Michelle.
Michelle Wolf?
Yes, Michelle Wolf. Thank you. Gosh, why could I not think of her name? She is a person on The Daily Show. Anyway, her new stand-up special on HBO is rip-roaring funny. I mean, so funny. I cried laughing almost through the entire thing. If you're a woman, you need to watch it. It's hilarious. That is what I have to say. HBO, Michelle Wolf's Nice Lady. Make sure you watch it. So funny.
Awesome.
That's what I have to say. Well, that's all for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you have enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast, and please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we will post links to our show notes as well on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.